The kind of genealogy and archaeology we want, and that is we want to discover, one, the danger of a kind of understanding of autonomy, rationality, and freedom that we now have in our normalizing enlightenment practices. Then we want to do a genealogy of that. And that's mostly done, I guess, because it would only trace it back to the beginning of the Enlightenment, maybe. I don't know. Maybe that's why he hasn't done any more of that. And the most you can expect that genealogy to do is to loosen the grip of these things on us. It won't sort of blow them apart the way a genealogy of the subject will, but it will make us see that things don't have to be that way, that they became that way. And then you would do an archaeology of the Stoic understanding of freedom, autonomy, and rationality, in which you would see that we couldn't have that anymore, since that requires the notion of the stable, rational structure of the cosmos, and therefore we won't be able to take the content, but something about the problem will be available to us as an alternative problem to the Renaissance, to the Enlightenment problem, which was somehow the wrong way to deal with this unmooring of reason, which was to make procedural reason, an instrumental reason, in its onward march, the essence of freedom and autonomy.
And one further point that Charles made was that what the Stoics did was to take the concerns of biopower, health and what have you, and not eliminate them, but make them a question of priority and preference, such that other things were higher values. But all that, once they were taken care of course you'd rather be healthy than not healthy. And
use the epidemic vaccination
example here, and that seems to be quite Foucault's own position. That adds up to a rather different view of maturity than the Kantian view.
What is the view of maturity?
That one has a sense of both substantive issues involved and a sense of proportional weighing of alternatives, and therefore priorities in which the primacy of either universal imperatives or health, etc., are not given, but must be evaluated from situation to situation.
Whereas maturity for Kant would be something like to have finally taken over the basic human task of the total rational ordering of everything.
Yeah. Good.
Okay, let's see. So critical reason is going to knock out traditional religious and metaphysical grounding and open up a space for reason to operate. And then what reason does, Heidegger says, is impose its own normative standards, or going to bring everything into a realm such that reason, so such that it's available to be organized systematically and ramified down into details. That is, procedural reason construes reality as the domain for the application of this procedural instrumental task. The Stoics faced the problem of how to live an ethical life in an impersonal society, but their solution, which we can't have, was to ground their life in the static order of the cosmos.
With entirely different norms.
Oh yeah, norms, that's what I forgot. They did have the notion of an aesthetic of existence and the notion that norms could be related to knowledge and reason without becoming procedural and instrumental.
That's right, they were preferential.
Okay, and that's right, among other things. For example, they had this preferential relation to health, and we have this example about vaccinations. Now constantly tries to remove shadows and illusions mm-hmm. and reveal the true needs of the community and the self.
And it's entirely procedural in that sense. That's exactly what he means by critical. That is to say, reason now is a function which he wants to situate in language to get as clear as possible, non-distorted communication, to get as clear as possible whatever is under discussion. Reason is thoroughly critical but has no content whatsoever.
Well, that's not right. I mean, that's what it looks like is that Foucault has Habermas in a disjunction of the sort that either he has to see what Kant saw, that there is no reality anymore to which reason corresponds, and that leads him into reason organizing the world better and better for its own procedural work, or he goes from the reality of the cosmos to the reality of the deep needs of the culture and the self, in which case he falls back into a position which Foucault's genealogy has already deconstructed.
And it's hardly universal.
Right. Okay, well, that's interesting. Habermas would say that it is what these needs, which reason critically is constantly clarifying, are both universal and it's a demand on us. By historicizing it genealogically, this notion of the deep truth, Foucault has shown both that it's not universal and that it doesn't make any unconditional demand.
And ultimately, Habermas wants to situate it in the species.
Right, which would be fine. I mean, so Foucault has, if you buy the genealogy of the notion of the truth of the self and the cogito and the unthought, then you see that, I think, so the point isn't the unconditioned good, but they just didn't think that health was what it was all about,
yeah.
And that what it was all about was this kind of universal rationality, and since that wasn't what it was all about, health could be given just its normal place.
Yeah, the other things being equal, when the good wasn't in question and you had a choice between doing something to make you healthy and to make you unhealthy, obviously you preferred.
Okay, well, that's good. We have to put it that way. That's
so
a good way to put it.
So preferred is our usual translation of it, is pragmon, in the way he said to that. I mean, I don't know if I'll get it very...
Well, you can keep trying.
...euphonious at the first
crack. Okay, that's all right.
Yes. Either because one believes that an even more radical critique of alienation, mystification, and distortion, something like that, will lead to full liberation and a realization of the original goals of the Enlightenment,
mm-hmm.
will lead by itself.
Uh-huh.
By itself.
Uh-huh.
Or... because of some substantive view of
the deep needs or truth of
human needs, mm-hmm. which such a critique will help to mm-hmm. uncover, something of that kind.
That's right.
Good. Well, that's fine.
States the two possible sides.
And it's no longer triumphant, clearly. The first one is no Voltairean triumphant optimism, but
yes.
A sort of the last hope we have sort of position. This is all we can do. We're not too hopeful about it, but this is the dignified thing to do. Yeah.
And they both suffer, though, from this kind of difficulty of these regulative principles of reason, that they're never achievable in fact, but only at the end of history.
Yeah.
And then you wonder sort of what it is to approach them if you can't ever figure out what it would be to achieve them.
But it's not unlike Foucault, because there's always dangers in Foucault that arise, so that we're always working to get things off our back that will never get put off our backs. It's not that,
right,
but
it
are,
is, but not in the name of not in the
yeah.
name of some ideal
yeah.
limit.
That's right. Yeah, yeah.
That's the difference. But
yeah.
the Kantian thing in there is the ideal limit in which
yeah.
everything will be all right, but it's not really conceivable in this world. I know
yes.
people worry about this a lot when they criticize Habermas and defend
yes.
Habermas.
Right.
Just in what status does this ideal speech community supposed to have?
Yeah.
But I don't know. I mean, anyway, okay.
Yes, it is a regulative ideal, which is not. Is so dismissive that the reader doesn't think you need to say anything.
Right,
about it.
But we do.
Where
now.
You word it now, you're
right.
Saying about it. And then your last sentence. So the genealogist sees the Enlightenment solution as either frankly and totally empty, as the first branch,
mm-hmm.
or as endlessly seeking a never accessible because of non-existent truth. Can't say because of non-existent. Endlessly accessible because of non-existent truth. Yeah.
Okay, but there was that. But now,
so frankly and totally empty. That's something
that we have to fix. But we also haven't quite got it, because we promised that we would show that his solution was part of the problem,
yeah,
which is a much stronger claim than just to show that his solution won't work.
Yeah.
And so we've got to say something about that. I mean, he has to become actually part of these, of this drive toward normalization, or else we have to take back the claim that his solution is part of the problem.
Well, sure. I mean, what else could it be, though, if you come in and again you have this referee view of critical reason, and people say, well, what I really want is to be able to jog 17 miles a day, so I'll live to be 120. And Jürgen says, well, you really, I see some distorted communication there. And, I mean, it is, sure, it's part of the problem. And we have to spell it out a little bit, but I don't think that part is...
Do you think that, that sounds...
I haven't understood
it. It's a parody.
It's a parody. It's too much of a parody. I mean, okay, let me go back to defending Habermas. I would say, well, maybe not defending Habermas, but seeing what Foucault actually said that I think could actually use the critique of Habermas. I think he sees part of the thrust of Habermas as dangerous in the way he does the other left-wing revolutionary participatory views, that it could be used as part of a left-wing politics that would once more start dragooning people. But do you think he sees it as part of the, you might say, established normalization?
Hmm.
He does. That's a terribly hard critique, my God. That's almost as insulting as the Habermas said about him.
Well, yeah, because
I
think he thinks...
Well, we have to get this figured out.
In
these, not here
in
yet.
These whatever it's called... These new arbitration procedures, for instance, in France, which are quasi-judicial,
yeah,
things that kind of arbitrage social, whatever it's called, that would seem to be that kind of a function, wouldn't it?
Well, you see, I think, I see a distinction, I thought he did too, between two kinds of dangers. The danger of the present structure normalizing this, and the danger of revolutionary, participatory, general will, Leninist type,
yeah,
movements, okay? And they really are different because they're enemies.
Sure.
They shoot each other in the streets, and some like Foucault, like a really good liberal, would like to see a plague on both their houses. Or, okay, I just can't see, I can see how he could think of Habermas as a potential encourager of that left thing. There is some truth in that. I can't see how Habermas could be tarred with anything involved. He's so himself critical of all the, I mean, in a Frankfurt School type way, of all the bureaucrats. Normalizing,
well, up to a point, but because they're distorted, because they're, I mean, I think he's also moving. I think he's moving away from,
mm-hmm,
perhaps against his will. He's backing. He's moving in the direction of
becoming more normalizing, maybe, or
yeah, more, well, more in favor of social democratic procedural safeguards is what, as you know, in the grim world was most.
Yeah, but then that's espousing a doctrine that Foucault already holds, which is not a normalization doctrine, but just a let's have normal checks and balances. I mean, Foucault is very much in favor of Montesquieu checks and balances,
yeah,
while being in disfavor of bureaucratic normalization.
Okay, can I try?
Yes.
I mean, why wouldn't it turn out in Habermas that when everybody got done with their distorted communication and got clear that what they would want was the perfect welfare state where everything was efficiently and radically and rationally ordered for the general health and production of everybody and everything, that everybody equally now, and so all the distortions were gone, and no, that's why I think it's part of what defense does one have against it going that way in Habermas?
Well, there's no defense of having it going that way, but there's no reason why it should go that way.
It has to go that way, I see.
More than everybody becomes a Foucault when they're totally liberated and distorted, and they're all off making aesthetic beauties of their lives.
Mm-hmm.
I
think that's true.
He hasn't got either one built in.
I see.
Yeah, I think that's true.
Then he's not part of the problem.
He's not part of that problem. I mean, I think that... Well,
but that's the only important problem for us, the biopower,
yeah,
problem,
yeah,
which is that... the normalization in the interests of greater welfare and efficiency,
yeah,
in which every area of life is more and more precisely,
yeah,
controlled and so forth. If that doesn't somehow follow as what would happen in the ideal speech community, then he's not part of the problem.
Yeah. I mean, you certainly can argue that he doesn't solve the problem, so I would say neither of these two interpretations of his will do. But it's much stronger than saying he's part of the problem. What he is part of is another thing Foucault is against, and you don't discuss it here at all, which is his fear of, roughly speaking, Marxist-type, Leninist-type, Rousseau-type politics.
But Habermas seems so far removed from that now.
Yes, Habermas is far removed from that, but I could see a case being made that some of the logic of this position.
Mm-hmm.
By its, see, I think this is what Foucault is really saying to us in your face, that first meeting, that when you have, you say, and this very high standard of totally free participating in community politics. And I hold that up not just as a purely critical thing, which is just used to destabilize what exists, but as something I'd actually be committed to realize if the opportunity arose. Then my position is going to perpetually generate lefty movements of this kind. And there's some.
Yeah.
That's not a. We take that seriously about Habermas. Not an off the wall objection.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's part of the reason for the stranger between them. Habermas smells this kind of.
You mean Foucault?
No, Habermas smells in Foucault this kind
see.
Of conservative,
I see.
I mean, this kind of liberal, traditional liberal rejection of that whole thing. And Foucault smells in Habermas. The other.
Yeah.
So, and that's a problem that you would argue Habermas is part of.
But let me do it on my philosophical level. You can talk to each of us in his own terms. Is it true then that you can separate the critical activity of reason from reason in its autonomy, following this regulative ideal of getting everything more and more organized under principles and all the
yes.
holes filled in? That they seem to be so tightly connected in Kant. And I can't help thinking.
Humboldt is the other guy. See,
who tries to break these two right
yes,
apart.
Because you see, Kant didn't want to give in to the Romantic movement, except in his very indirect way in the Third Critique. He refused this whole picture of expressive nature, which we all have deeply within us, and we have to find, which gives you a kind of content. It's a renewed content. Analogous to the meaningful universe of the cosmos.
Okay,
the
I see. Yes, if you have that content, you can break across apart these
right.
two.
And Humboldt was, very much picked up that whole romantic idea. So Humboldt's idea of individual freedom is we each discover the sort of irreplaceable thing we have in ourselves to be, and we all have a society in which we all discover that. Now, it isn't something like the cosmos that's all there. It has to be realized, but it has to be realized over against a potentiality which is not just anything at all, but has a definite shape.
Okay. But if Habermas has a completely negative critical view of reason as constantly clearing up distortions and alienations and so forth, can he help but by sort of the other side of that view of critical reason sort of making things safe for the positive side of reason, which is then the regulative principle of and all that, and we're back in. I mean, is Habermas enough of a romantic
yes.
to keep from buying the whole Kantian
theme? He's Humboldtian to that extent that he thinks that we have these deep, each of us has these deep needs and we bring them out and so on. But what he doesn't want to do, for some reason to do with his background, and that makes him stick to this bloody procedural way of putting it, he doesn't want to make that positive doctrine of what we're like part of the actual argument.
Mm-hmm.
For saying a given society is better. I'd like Frankie, like Humboldt, to say a given society is better because it fits better what we are, what we actually are.
But he resists that in his work.
He resists that. He wants to have the purely procedural thing, but the procedural thing does make sense only against the background of a view of each of us as having different kinds of needs, which we then can undistort. See, the whole idea of undistortedness does
yeah.
presuppose.
Okay. Yeah, but why isn't he then in the following dilemma, which is the same old dilemma we had already, but I think more refined? Either critical reason is negative and has to go with a kind of procedural view of positive reason, which it's clearing the road for, and that certainly makes him part of the problem.
Mm-hmm.
Or he has this notion of this deep truth, which is what critical reason is opening the way for, but then what keeps that deep truth from becoming something that we ought to have a science of and knowledge of and get it and pull it into the other Foucaultian problem?
We can have a knowledge of it because we have this very sharp Dilthey dichotomy between in the interpretive understanding and natural science. Natural science deals with objects that we try to control and manipulate. Mm-hmm. And interpretation reaches its apogee when we understand each other.
That's not going to work because Freud is the perfect example of, according to Foucault, of this merger of decipherment and knowledge. That's only old-fashioned sort of Newtonian knowledge, but the knowledge is now there are sciences for deciphering the real, the deep truth. Those are just the ones that Foucault is most worried about.
Yes, but they are, Habermas doesn't unfortunately say this, but he ought to say. They are bogus to the extent that they make such a claim.
But Habermas is the last to say this, being all full of loving of psychotherapy.
He's loving psychotherapy, but it is really implicit in his very strong, he's very strong defender of the natural versus Christ's distinction, right? He's one of the strongest defenders around. He and I stand back to back, Rorty and others shooting at us. So the logic of that, the way he draws that distinction.
That distinction gets subsumed in Foucault's system, where any old Wissenschaft is just as much as any other going to draw the whatever it's a Wissenschaft of into the power knowledge system.
Yes, but then that's unfairly switching a Foucauldian definition into a Habermasian doctrine. Habermasian doctrine is that the sciences of man, properly speaking, are interpretive. That is, their criterion of success, the interest they serve, is mutual understanding. So just as you know you have a better natural science doctrine, you can manipulate the world better. You know you have a better social science doctrine, you can understand each other better non-distortively. But that means that the idea of using these to normalize has to be ruled out. Because
it sounds like exactly what normalization is.
No. I mean, not if you take the full Humboldtian...
Right, but short of that...
...background, which he really does assume. He doesn't just use it as a positive doctrine, but he does assume it when he talks about undistorted communication. It's something each one of us has it in us to be and say, which undistorted communication is criterially measured in terms of what they're saying. Right? Mm. Only nobody can say it for anyone else beforehand, so we can only get at that by a procedural notion of what releases the language of the undistorted communication. You couldn't use a bit of social science for normalizing purposes, if that is by normalizing purposes, you mean imposing an alien.
But if that other didn't exist, then you wouldn't be imposing in any strong sense. But no, you wouldn't be. I mean, all you'd be imposing was welfare norms, which everyone could quite easily agree with, the things they wanted to live up to.
Yeah, but this has to come from their deep undistorted agreement. I mean, you see, one mustn't try to criticize Habermas as though he had a Foucault doctrine of Nietzschean self-instruction, but actually has a Humboldt doctrine. Self-discovery at the basic. So, if I come along with this normalizing picture of what you all would like to try in the name of social science to impose on, I have, by his criteria, bad social science, because what I'm doing is not aiding undistorted understanding, but on the contrary, preventing you from finding your true self, participating in the debate. It's bad social science. He really is guarded against this.
If I could understand a certain piece of Foucault, I understand, though, a new criticism. I mean, Foucault thinks that the part B, if you subscribe to the imperative to put the truth of the self into words, as he keeps harping about in the second book, you're part of the problem. If we knew why he said that, we could easily find that Habermas was part of the problem, because certainly there's an imperative to put the truth of the self into words in Habermas. But now I turn to Paul. Why does Foucault think that if you believe in this imperative to put the truth of the self into words, you're part of the problem?
I will put it more starkly than he's ever willing to put it, because he has a business of just doing historical stuff. But it's this. The putting the truth of the self into words comes from a metaphysical horizon which says there is what you like to know, deep truth of the self. But the truth is that there only is if you make it so in that sense there isn't. So this prevents you, this chains you and prevents you from really taking the full leverage to make yourself.
To create yourself,
right? And anybody who believes that whether he likes it or not, there isn't deep truth of the self, is, as it were, chained up and incapable of taking the full leverage
That's the ethical problem he was talking about while he was here. But what about the biopower problem? I mean, in the sex book, it's not put as an ethical problem. It's put that you contribute to the normalization of biopower if you subscribe to the imperative to put the truth itself into words. Now, why is that?
Well, I think that, frankly, this is just under-motivated thesis in the book. And I think that, not you put it that way, I would say the following. I think that he's mixed up the more general thesis that we just described.
The ethical thesis,
which is one way of saying that it's a bad and a chaining up doctrine to believe this, with a more specific historical one, that's a particular form of chaining up, which is Romanized medicine, biopower, is involved in this. Because in the name of power medicine, in the name of all those Hobbesian leftists and so on, down to the ages, I protest against the idea that believing in the deep self is by itself.
And the imperative to put it into words.
And the imperative to put words, yeah. I mean,
What he would say is something like, well, if what we had witnessed in the last 200 years was just a lot of free folks getting together and talking about their needs, that would be one thing, but in fact we have a vast array of institutions where when people get together to talk about their deep selves, there happen to be a lot of experts around, paid by the state, etc., 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 and this is an accelerative process whereby once you get a few, you get more and more of these experts, and now anytime anyone goes through any crisis in their life, or not crisis in their life, they're guided and shaped and whatever by discourse, the second, which is supported institutionally, which is famously refined, that's not impossible.
Okay, but I have a Frankfurter Schuller answer to that, which is, this is a wonderful, good thing discovered in the modern world, so naturally it was taken over by structures of power and capitalism, and they captured a big part of it. But there's always been this small guerrilla band of true convulsions fighting against it, and we break out and free the world, and we...
Sure, and he calls that the repressive hypothesis, and sees that as one of the great illusions of the last
200
years.
That's right, but this is this notion of the repressive hypothesis is, I say, undermotivated. It's not clear that the arguments for that, well, I don't think the arguments even for the wider thesis are that decisive. I don't agree with that either. But what I mean to say is there is a hiatus between the wider and the narrower thesis. It's not sufficient to show, even if you were a Nietzsche, and you thought that the deep self was historical invention, so it chains you up to believe it. That isn't by itself enough to show that you have to be involved in this more narrowly defined mode of normalization.
No, it's just that he points at all the history of the liberation movements who are not just your average state hospitals, but, Freudians would write through Marxism, whatever, in which the great proclaimers of the truth contributed to.
Yeah, but in what way is that kind of argument different from a certain extreme members of the women's movement one here saying, well, Aristotle was misogynist, Shakespeare was misogynist, so consign all our works to the flames? I mean, the idea that the whole enterprise must be condemned because it's been...
Well, I suppose that would be a question of interpretation in some level or other, whether or not the net result of the Freudian movement has been beneficial or not.
Oh, but the Freudian movement, we're not talking about it. We're talking about the Humboldtian, the whole romantic thing. See, the issue is whether...
If we're talking about six guys, and that's...
Oh, it's a lot. No, it's not just six guys. I mean, it's a long, substantive part of our, anyway, intellectual and artistic culture that people rebelled against in the name of self-expression.
Well, artistic is something else, but the
it's very much part of it. Romantic movement is linked to a whole.
Yeah, no, I know. Sense. Yeah, sure, no. For sure.
So it's more than just
the question of what the political effect of that is.
Oh, I agree. It's minority political views. But I mean, that's exactly the same parallel that the women's movement would say. The number of people who actually had proper views on women in the whole corpus of literature is very small. So you could sign it all.
I'm not sure because I don't understand
which
that.
You want to say, well, look, I mean, there's not necessarily an organic connection to these wrong views on women. And the actual aesthetic value of these works, so it's absurd. And similarly here, I want to say that...
Yeah, but he's not... First of all, Foucault's not assigning anything to Flynn. Secondly, he's not interested in essences, so that seems like totally...
Throughout history,
the same position is always...
The analogy I'm trying to make is the following, that the fact that the self-expressive movement has been politically taken over for the most part, doesn't itself prove that there's a vice in it itself. Hypothesis about it. You need a causal hypothesis.
Oh yeah, no, I don't think he. I mean, he's not. Again, that maybe it certainly is coy at times that he says he's a historian. But if in fact you can read that as what's happened.
Yeah. No, but then you see. Remember the issue where all this.
Yeah,
is made
I'm
up.
Exhausted, so I'm probably lost.
Okay, but let me tell you the issue is Habermas part of the normalization problem? Okay,
right.
Habermas could be proved to be part of the normalization problem if quay Humboldtian.
Yeah.
It were proved that Humboldtism in general. Not only has been taken over, but somehow collaborated in something.
Yeah, although we're also arguing that whether or not this Humboldtianism, I mean, whether or not we're talking about Charles Taylor or Jürgen Habermas, in other words, whether this Humboldtianism is really an important part of Habermas's
it's
position.
It's important part of Habermas. It plays a not a central role in his arguments. It plays in my argument.
Yeah.
That does play a role in his argument. He doesn't use it by saying Humboldt gives us an actual substantive model of what a humanly good society is, let's go get it.
Mm.
He rather goes through this crazy procedural term.
Yeah.
But the procedural term with the notion of undistortedness requires a Humboldtian anthropology in the background to make sense.
Although he doesn't tell us about it.
Yeah. Well, he does from time to time in interviews say Humboldt's a great guy. So he there. Now, the thing is, you need that.
But for a man who tries to make, as opposed to Foucault, who tries to make absolutely as explicit and as coherent and as spelled out, the fact that the center of his position is found in here and there in interviews
it's not the center. I mean, it's
no, but the essential presupposition to save him from nihilism and bile power.
Yeah.
You'd think he'd have more to say about it.
Yeah. Well, no, he doesn't run around hiding it either. He just
hasn't gotten around to it.
Well, I mean, just so hammering at trying to get this damn. Undistorted communication thing, right, which he never can do. It's a matter of his energy spent, I think, on this hopeless enterprise. But anyway, so he is, in that sense, a Humboldtian. Right? He doesn't front it the way I do. He doesn't use the ultimate idea, but he is a part of his art. So you could say, in virtue of that, I mean, now I'm getting back to what Bert was saying earlier, can we show that he's part of the problem? On Foucaultian grounds, that anybody who espouses this doctrine,
putting the truth into words,
somehow is doing something which, by its own inner logic,
that's what I would like to see,
must lead to normalization. However, the guy himself may repudiate it, but you know, something like the inner logic, like you want to say the inner logic of Rousseau is totalitarianism in some respects is true, even though he himself would first be horrified, Marx would go crazy over Lenin. That kind of argument can be made about certain writers. Can it be made about Humboldtians in general, and therefore Habermas as a Humboldtian? That's the only way you could do it. And I frankly do not see how that argument can be made. I can see, as I say, the weaker argument that it prevents you from being a Nietzschean, Foucaultian self-builder, if you have this belief. Which is
the ethical
objection. And I can see the actual historical argument that, in fact, it has been taken over. But that's no more here or there. Let me give you another example. Then, you know, Stoicism may have been taken over by God knows who.
What an era.
Yeah. and you wouldn't, it's unless it sort of lends itself to that, you don't consider it a vice of the doctrine.
Mm-hmm.
I think you're going to have trouble proving the stronger thesis of Humboldtianism in general, and therefore, albeit I think it's in some way deep down believed by Foucault. Maybe that's what you've got to say, it's believed by Foucault, but it isn't.
Well, I don't know, we'll have to think about what we have to say. I mean, we'll have to renegotiate this. I mean, I don't know what Paul thinks, and I think he's too tired to want to do it now. And I'd be inclined just not to try to go to the mat with Habermas in one paragraph and forget the I don't know. I mean, unless we can
I don't
see
care
how to
that
do
much
it.
About Habermas.
Yeah, well, I would like to shoot down Habermas,
yeah.
But I mean, but we have to discuss when we're both rested tomorrow morning whether we can tune up this paragraph so that it shoots down Habermas rather than just annoys Habermasians and makes them feel that, just as they always thought, Foucault doesn't really have any dead aim on them. I mean, either we got to really make it clear that we've, you know, got a beat on Habermas, or not get Foucault into more trouble than he is. Then that's really the moral of this.
Strategically, I would be for peace, partly because I like both the guys, but partly, I mean, a counteroffensive across the... Okay, the new material in the second edition casts a flood of light on the whole basis of Foucault's moral position and historical outlook. This is especially important in that Foucault seems to be in the course of redefining his thought on a number of crucial issues. This interview and interpretive essay go to the very center of the tremendously important new theory.
Let's say the new interviews and interpretive essay.
Yes.
Okay. Go.
Go to the very center of the tremendously important new theory Foucault will be expounding in his forthcoming books.
Sounds perfect.
I want to put that because I mean.
Right. No, I think that's terrific.
Say we've got to buy this to understand the books.
Right. Oh, that's terrific. That seems.
In that seminar situation. And the principal speakers would be brought in as, so to speak, resource people. In one of the days that we were interested in inviting you to take part in was going to be on the topic of objectivizing subjects.
Uh-huh.
And that we construe very loosely so as to fit the speakers. But we had thought of you as one of the principal speakers for that session. The remuneration will be $350 plus travel and expenses.
Well,
and probably it's still.